episode 216 of the Cricket Her Weekly. We've barely recovered from the first T20 international of the summer, England v Pakistan at Edgbaston yesterday. England won in the end by 53 runs, so it looks like a lovely big tick in the scorebook for Heather Knight & Co. However, England did begin in rather chaotic fashion, being 11 for 4 at one stage, Sid. What an interesting match.
Yeah, it wasn't a great start by England, but they pulled it back. And, you know, I mean, Pakistan were actually not very good generally. They had, obviously, they held on to some catches right at the very beginning when England decided to present them with those four wickets pretty much on a plate, three catches and a pretty crazy run out. Pakistan yeah. did make a good start to their innings.
They did.
You know, they went off at a good rate and didn't lose too many wickets. But then they suffered a horrendous collapse of their own, even worse. They lost five wickets for 10 runs.
Yeah.
And obviously there was going to be no coming back from that. But really, you know, from England's perspective, I don't think it's... there's not that many positives to take, really. I mean, I guess Amy Jones played well, you know, and we've raised so many concerns about Amy Jones' ability to handle pressure over the years. And I just wonder if it now feels like we have kind of turned a corner with that, and that, you know, she is handling that better, and she like understands how to kind of overcome the nervous issues that were clearly there, and she's admitted were there. So you know, that's
she has
positive.
A tendency to play very well at Edgbaston as well. So I'm wondering whether she is becoming increasingly like she feels comfortable at Edgbaston specifically. It's not necessarily a great theory because they're not going to play very many internationals at Edgbaston in the summer. You're only going to get probably one or two max. So unless they have another Commonwealth Games and it's all at Edgbaston, then let's hope that it's not that. But it just feels like whenever England play at Edgbaston, Amy Jones does well these days. Now, Sid, you did trial the new Win Her tool, didn't you? And interesting, because the way Win Her works is that it gives you the most likely outcome of who's going to win at the halfway stage of the second innings. That's right, isn't
that's
it?
That's right, yeah.
So in a T20, that's 10 overs into the second innings.
Yeah, so we crunched the data from hundreds and hundreds of women's cricket games. It's exclusively based on women's cricket, which makes it a bit different to some of the other women predictors that are out there, which use a lot of men's games as their basis. And yeah, what it's saying is that, you know, if you look at the halfway point in the second innings, how likely is it that the team that are batting are going to win and the team that are bowling are going to win, obviously converse. And the verdict of the tool was that Pakistan were on track to win. They had about a 75% chance of winning at the halfway point. And obviously now...
That went down really well on social media, didn't it?
Given what subsequently happened, that was obviously, you know, it didn't go down like that. But that doesn't actually mean that Win Her was wrong or that it's got nothing to tell you. Because I think the really important thing that it tells you is that if England get themselves into a position where they've posted a total, but, you know, a team get, you know, a good chunk of that total knocked off within the first 10 overs, they don't lose too many wickets because Pakistan were only three down at that point,
Yeah. Then
you're probably going to lose the match. Now, of course, against Pakistan, England didn't go on to lose the match. But the really significant thing is why England can't take too many positives from this is that if it had been against, you know, India or Australia or South Africa or New Zealand, there's a very good chance that they wouldn't have done that. They were really dependent upon Pakistan collapsing in a heap. And England's recovery earlier had been dependent upon some really poor Pakistan fielding. Yeah. It really felt like wherever England hit the ball, they found a gap. Nita Dar's field placements were bizarre, I think. And she was leaving huge gaps that England were just continually hitting into, and that they were never being plugged. And England would just go, well, okay, I'll carry on, you know, driving towards mid-on because there's an enormous gap there. And I'm just milking runs every single time. And someone that I know that watched, a friend of mine that watched the A match, the warm-up match, which England played against, or England, sorry, England A played against Pakistan, said exactly the same thing. The field placements were really static. And England just worked out the field placements and were just like, well, okay, we'll hit the ball where the fielders are. And the fielders... So England kind of gifted that game, but...
Can I say I've done a lot of... spent many, many hours of crunching numbers and data of my own, and I've discovered that when you're 11 for 4 in a T20, you don't really win very often.
Yep.
that's my very sophisticated analysis. And exactly as you said, I mean, it was a massive let-off for England, wasn't it? I think credit to Danny Gibson, we should say, with the bat as well, because we mentioned Amy Jones, but I thought that actually what Danny Gibson did was manage to walk the tightrope successfully between aggression and, okay, obviously she had a little bit of an advantage of coming out a bit later in the innings and having a little bit more scope to do that once the rebuild job had happened with Jones and Knight. But she played positively, but not stupidly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was the ideal position for her to come in and, you know, do that classic, you know, hit 40 off 20 runs. You know, but she executed.
Balls, yeah.
Hit 40 off 20 balls. But she came in and she executed, and that's the important thing, you know, and not everyone's going to do that. So, yeah, big positive for her. You know, to a certain extent, she's still playing for her place in the team. You know, Nat Sivrell, we think, will be back in the next game. She's one of the people that might miss out. If they decide that, you know, I mean, she did have one horrendous over with the ball, which went for over 20 to 21 runs, I think.
She did, but at the other end, Lauren Bell was getting tonked a little bit as well by the Pakistani openers. So I think it's probably more likely that they'll drop Freya Kemp, unfortunately. But we did have an interesting comment on your piece on Cricket Her, Sid, from Martin Saxon. He says, has anyone crunched the numbers and found out in what percentage of matches England are having a batting collapse right now? On the one hand, Australia no longer appear invincible, but with so many England collapses of late, you just wouldn't stake much on Helen Knight lifting their world trophy later this year. And I think that that kind of sums it up, because what we were saying on the way home, Sid, was specifically kind of, I was saying that actually it feels like John Ball as a strategy, the kind of ratio of wins to losses playing in that way doesn't justify it. As a strategy, right? Because yes, you will occasionally have matches like England had a couple in the World Cup last year where they just come out all cylinders firing, and you just go, wow, oh my goodness, I haven't seen them play like that before. But too often it descends into 11 for 4 territory.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I kind of sort of get where John Ball's coming from in terms of, like, you're going, well, you know, if you want to beat Australia in a World Cup final when Australia are at their best, then you need to play cricket at the very bleeding edge. And that, you know, that's why we're doing it. We're doing it so that we can beat Australia in that final when Australia play as well as they did at the MCG in 2020. And okay, yes, but the trouble is that you need to get to that final first. And if you have too many implosions like the ones that we've seen recently, you're not going to get to that final in the first place. So, you know, it's a balance, and perhaps a balance that's best encapsulated by Alice Capsey's continuing struggles, Raf. That, you know, she's going all out for it. And, you know, she is winning games for England. She has won games for England in the last couple of years. But, you know, there are also quite a lot of times where, you know, she's doing what she did yesterday.
This is a team who are much weaker than England. This is a team who have a captain who doesn't know how to set field placements. Alice Capsey should be all over this fielding, this team and this attack. And she isn't so far. This is ideal Alice Capsey territory to stamp her authority and go, I'm not having it. I'm not having people question my place in the team and whether I'm worth it. I'm going to score 100.
Do what Tammy did all those years ago against Pakistan back in 2016, and, you know, make yourself the undroppable player at that point.
Yeah, so that's a challenge. She's clearly not going to be watching the Cricket Her Weekly, but just in case. In other news, Sid, it was almost a week ago now, actually, that we watched Scotland v Ireland in the semi-final of the World Cup qualifier. And it didn't quite have the result that we were expecting, did it? Thanks to one Ms. Catherine Bryce.
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. Well, I thought I was perhaps expecting that result.
Were you?
Right?
Okay.
Well, you know,
interesting.
I mean, at the
everyone
end of the day,
said that Ireland were the favourites.
Well, you know, and Ireland are, you know, the sort of the senior nation in terms of they're a full member of the ICC, and, you know, certainly, you know, for a long time, Ireland would consistently beat Scotland every single time, and quite convincingly.
Yeah.
But I just think, pound for pound, these days, Scotland are probably a better side than Ireland.
Interesting.
Because, the best Scottish player is probably, you know, better than the best Irish player, or at least the best Irish player that still plays for Ireland. Obviously, you know, Kim Garth, you know, would potentially have made a difference if Ireland held on to her.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just think that, pound for pound, Scotland are a better side. Why are they a better side? Well, Raf, you have a theory, and it's to do with the fact that Ireland are a full nation, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's any doubt about the fact that having full member status has not been entirely positive in terms of Ireland women's cricket. And the reason being that what it means, effectively, is that players have to choose between continuing to play for Ireland and counting as non-international players or non-overseas players if they wanted to go and play domestic cricket in England. So the reason why Scotland are a much stronger team than they were 5 years ago is because you've got 5 years now of players like Catherine and Sarah Bryce and many others playing professionally in the English domestic system and being able to also go back and then play for Scotland. Yeah. Whereas Irish players cannot do that because of the ICC's regulations about switching between full and associate cricket.
Yeah, absolutely. So Ireland players can only play as official overseas players in the RHF, which means they're competing with all the Australians and things. They can only have one of them per side. If the Scotland players had to play under those circumstances in the RHF, then people like Rachel Slater and Abta Magsood, for example, almost certainly would have played virtually zero, if not zero, RHF games rather than the decent number that those people have played.
Exactly.
Even the Catherine and Sarah Bryce, they'd have had to have found different, you know, franchises to go and play for because they couldn't both have played for Lightning stroke Blaze because there's only one overseas player allowed. So Scotland have taken advantage of that.
Yeah. And that's meant that this gap that did exist, I think, between Ireland and Scotland has now narrowed. And Scotland, as you say, well, they've just demonstrated that they can go kind of side by side along Ireland and actually beat them in the match when it mattered. So amazing, amazing result for Scotland. But where does it leave Ireland?
Well, it leaves them in a very tricky situation. Yeah. Our understanding is that they have effectively already cancelled a series. There was an unofficially announced series they were supposed to be playing this summer as a warm-up going towards the matches later in the summer. They're definitely not going to play that now. And it does leave the matches against England, you know, in some doubt. You would hope that they would play the ODIs against England because they're ICC championship matches, but it's certainly possible that they could forfeit one or more of them. I think now they probably won't play the T20s against England because they don't have any money.
Yeah.
Because you get a huge chunk of money for qualifying for for that T20 World Cup. Scotland won't have that money.
Yeah. it's very dog eat dog, isn't it? And just shows that the way in which funding is distributed, this is not an original thought, but the way in which the funding is distributed in international cricket is very uneven.
Yeah, and you know, Scotland will obviously have the advantage for the short term, and possibly ongoing if they can continue to keep their players playing in the RHF. But of course, one of Scotland's big ambitions is that they want full member status. Of course, if they get full member status, that's going to mean that loads of their players can no longer play in that RHF.
That's got to be a concern, hasn't it? Also, just to continue on the theme of the qualifier, Scotland did then go on and play Sri Lanka in the final, and Sri Lanka beat them fairly easily, which is probably what you would expect. But at that point, Scotland have already won the big prize. And in fact, potentially, they've won an even bigger prize by losing to Sri Lanka, because Sri Lanka have to be in the group of death in the World Cup, right? And play Australia and India and New Zealand. Whereas Scotland gets to be in England's group, which, can I just say that England v Scotland in a World Cup is going to be an amazing game. I really hope we get to see that one, Sid.
Yeah.
We did have a question from Mark Williams, kind of on this topic about Scotland, but also based on the conversation we had last week about John Lewis getting Bess Heath to ask Danny Hazel if she could wicket keep in the Rachel Hayden Trophy. So he's basically saying, will Scotland's interim coach Craig Wallace now engage in similar wanting for Scottish players in the Rachel Hayhoe-Flint Trophy? And there's a whole list of all of the Scottish players who are playing in the RHF. So is that going to happen, Sid? Are we going to start getting demands from Craig Wallace?
I think if Craig Wallace has got any sense, which I'm sure he has, and I think that Scotland more widely will actually keep very quiet about this now. They certainly don't want to be going making demands of the RHF coaches, because the RHF coaches will go back to the ECB and go, Cricket Scotland are making noises here. At the end of the day, rightly or wrongly, whatever you think about the way the system should and shouldn't be set up, Scotland are effectively freeloading off the English system at the moment. Now, it's quite a loaded word for me to have used, and possibly a little bit of an unfair word, but the fact remains that Scotland with one voice are saying we want to be an independent country as far as cricket is concerned, but they're also quietly just allowing England to fund their female professional system. And if they draw too much attention to that, then there's the risk that the ECB could shut it down anyway and just find some other, you know, means apart from the ICC's rules of preventing those players from competing in the RHF, which would just leave everybody worse off.
Yes,
so basically, bottom line is Scotland are not going to be going to
that. It's important to say that England would lose out if we lost these Scottish players, right?
The English domestic system would become weaker, absolutely,
Yeah, there's no doubt that, for example, the Brices have made regional cricket better. And regional cricket being better is actually better for English cricket as well. So at the moment, there's give on both sides. But what you're saying is that if Scotland
start pushing too hard, then the ECB might at that point go, we're going to take a closer look at what's going on here. So
Maybe. I think that would be very counterproductive, given that we've somehow got to find 60 new professionals to stack up in our new system, new tier one county system by 2029. So I think, okay. Anyway, moving on to a different topic entirely, Sid. There's been a piece by George De Bell published in The Cricketer this week, a bit of an exclusive about the ECB and Afghanistan. He's spoken to, I think it was Richard Thompson at the ECB, who says that basically the ECB will not schedule any bilateral cricket against Afghanistan due to their stance on women's cricket. So we just wanted to address this briefly because, it is an exclusive. What's interesting is that the ECB do freely admit that they don't currently have any bilateral cricket scheduled against Afghanistan, but what they're saying is we're not intending to schedule any.
It's a bit like me announcing to you, Raph, I'm not going to date Taylor Swift.
Okay, good. Thanks for that, Sid. Well, it does feel like the ECB are trying to have their cake and eat it a little bit, in the sense of they want people to pat them on the back and go, well done, this is a really brave stance that you're taking here, but they're not losing anything. And just as Australia are, they've actually said, we will continue to play them in World Cups. So there's absolutely nothing that they've lost here. So it doesn't really feel like a particularly kind of meaningful stance to me.
On the other hand, they have done it, and you know the argument when we discussed this with Australia is they did make that move, even if there were caveats to it.
I thought it was interesting, there was actually a quote in the piece from Richard, who says, "We've been working on discussions at ICC level with other member countries to understand what action can be taken. I don't think there is appetite for action amongst the majority of ICC members directly against Afghanistan, and therefore the unilateral element kicks in." So what he's saying is the ECB have to act by themselves, because effectively the rest of the ICC are a bit useless. But it does show that the lack of influence of the ECB within the ICC as a whole on this issue. He's basically saying we can't change that stance.
The ECB and Cricket Australia together can't be influential in that way. Yeah. Then, where does the influence lie within the ICC? I mean, I think we all know the answer to that question. Some ways, not unfairly, given that the vast majority of the world's cricket playing population is in India. But the ECB and Australia are starting to learn their place here in the new pecking order, I think.
Yeah.
And it's probably not where they thought they were going to be.
Mm. Well, I just think it's, as we've continually said, I think that it's a travesty, and that in a few years' time, we'll look back on this in the way that we look back on the apartheid era now, in terms of in terms of cricket potentially being able to have an influence in this situation, and not exercising its influence. Another further grim news, Sid. Privatisation of the 100 has moved a step closer this week. Crickinfo reports that on Friday, the counties gave their approval for the sort of privatisation process to continue. The idea is that I think that the ECB will kind of create 8 new companies. So they currently own the 100 teams themselves. So they're going to create these 8 new companies, and they're going to say, okay, the counties who are responsible for the 100 teams can have 51% shares in them, and then 49% shares would then be sold centrally by the ECB to, quote, interested parties.
Yeah, I mean, we're back here again, and it looks like, you know, it is going to happen. And I just want to just put forward a couple of questions. We have talked about this a few times in the past. The first is, you know, you're going to hope to generate a lot of money from this. What's going to happen to that money? Where is that money actually going to go? What governance structures are in place to ensure that this money is spent sensibly and in the long-term interests of the game? Because all the evidence for every time anything like this has ever happened in sport is that most of the money ends up in a massive round of inflation of the top players' salaries, by which we mean top male players' salaries, and that all the money therefore just kind of disappears into the ether. And, you know, if, say, Essex get their, you know, 33 million or whatever it is, what are they going to do with it? Are they going to, you know, use it to build a new ground and that's going to last them 100 years? Or are they going to use it to go, well, actually, if we use maybe 20 million of it for, you know, for the next 5 years to pay some players' salaries, we could have like the best men's team in the world? But of course, Kent are also doing that, and Warwickshire are also doing the same thing. Suddenly, the top men are earning 500,000 a year rather than 250,000 a year, and the money's disappeared within 5 years. Yeah. And then what are the ECB going to do? How are they going to put in those governance structures to ensure that that doesn't happen? And then the other question is, you know, you're selling a huge stake in, you know, your August calendar to interested parties. These interested parties, in whose interests are they going to run cricket once they are in control of it? Because it's important to understand that while the ECB now are going, well, they've only got a 49% stake, so they're not in control. But of course, once you've got a 49% stake, you only need somebody else to sell you 2% more, and now you are in control. So we're effectively giving them, like, so close to, we're giving them an inch from control. They'll take that extra inch, and then what are they going to do with that? Do you think, are Indian billionaires or Saudi billionaires, are they going to run cricket in the interests of cricket in this country, in the interests of ordinary people, ordinary viewers, ordinary fans, or are they going to run cricket in the interests of themselves? What do you
think? I feel very anxious about this, because a lot of what you say is kind of applicable for fans of men's English, of English men's cricket, right? But we, women's cricket, is very much now tied in with these other structures, and especially in the context of the 100. But yeah, it feels like women's cricket, and I've said this before, women's cricket isn't having a voice in these conversations and in these debates. These debates are currently being had by the counties, but there's no regional representation here. There's nobody, it feels like, fighting for the interests of women's cricket. In terms of who might buy these 49% stakes, well, it's quite likely to be kind of IPL owners, right? Indian billionaires who don't have a great track record in terms of women's cricket. They've bought teams in South Africa.
But surely, Raph, when they bought the teams in South Africa, they set up women's teams as well, didn't they?
No, they didn't, Sid.
But surely when they set up Major League Cricket in the United States, they set up women's teams as well, didn't they, Raph?
No, they didn't. Exactly that. So that's it. It's about the track record of these people and whether they actually care about developing women's cricket. And the whole kind of USP of the 100 is meant to be that sort of equity piece. And it just feels like this is going to move a step away from that. But we just feel completely powerless. There's nothing we can really do. And there isn't even a kind of outlet for women's cricket to express its concerns about this. There are men's counties who are saying they're concerned, obviously, especially the ones who aren't going to own a 100 team, are concerned about this. But not from a women's cricket perspective, just from a power perspective. We're actually concerned about it from a kind of, what happens to the women's players? And does women's cricket even, you know, will women's cricket even continue in the 100 in the way that it does at the moment, in the way that it is a central part of it at the moment? And so I just feel that those questions aren't even being asked at the moment. There's nobody to represent us, and it does make me very concerned.
You know what we need, Raph?
What do we need?
Female Rage, the women's cricket edition.
That was a Taylor Swift reference, just in case anyone didn't get it, because Sid, I hate to break it to you, but not everybody is a Swiftie.
It's all right.
Sorry. Finally this week, Sid, just this morning, a couple of hours before we came on air, we've seen that Yorkshire Post have got an exclusive. They've revealed that Yorkshire, in the wake of not being awarded a Tier 1 team, or at least not been awarded a Tier 1 team for the next 2 years, have actually are now pursuing a different path. They are going to go to the ECB, or they have gone to the ECB, they've written to the ECB, and they've said, okay, what we're going to do is, here's a compromise position, we're going to self-fund our professional women's team, but please let us into Tier 1, thank you very much, signed Yorkshire CCC. So this is an interesting path that they're pursuing here. We talked in previous episodes about the fact that we don't think that anybody has a legal leg to stand on in terms of challenging the ECB's process, because it was written into the tender document that basically the ECB's decision is final. So Yorkshire are trying to, by a roundabout way, say, look, we'll put our own money in, we'll dig deep, even deeper into the pockets of Colin Graves, and we'll fund it ourselves. But we want to be in Tier 1, and there's the catch, isn't it, Sid?
I just don't see how the ECB can possibly say yes to this. They can't allow the rules to be bent again. They should have already learnt their lesson that having bent the rules once, you bend the rules once for Yorkshire, and suddenly they're asking you to re-bend them again.
Yeah.
And it's like, we've already said to the counties that won the bids, yeah, you won the bids under these conditions, but we've moved the goalposts slightly, and we're going to introduce two more teams 2 years before, you know, we said that we were going to.
Yeah.
And are you going to now move the goalposts again? How are you going to justify that to Durham? You know, Durham are trying now to set up their team, and you're going, well, actually, Durham, I know you bid on the basis that effectively you were bidding for the North East franchise, but actually Yorkshire are still going to have a team, and, you know, so they're probably going to have all the players, and what? And I guess the other side of the coin is that this can only work, it can only work if there's a full draft. It could work if you have a full draft, where you say, okay, everyone gets a round-robin pick, and you can pick one player, and then you pick another player, and then you pick another player, and therefore that will balance out the teams. Because if you don't have a full draft and allow this to go ahead,
all of the Diamonds players will stay at Yorkshire, and Durham will struggle to recruit players.
And not going to be able to put together a team.
Yeah.
So if you had a full draft, that would work, but you can't go changing the rules now and say there's a full draft, not least because we know at least one player is effectively already committed to a county for next year, Heather Knight.
Yeah.
Heather Knight has already signed, as far as we're aware, it was publicly announced that she's signed the contract, she's going to become a director at Somerset. That means she's effectively guaranteed that she's going to play at Somerset, because
pretty much
she's not going to become a director at Somerset and they go, hey, by the way, Somerset guys, sorry, but I've actually signed a contract to play at Durham, but I'll still be your director. Obviously
we actually don't know how the England player allocation is going to work, right? But because we haven't heard anything, and because of the Heather Knight thing, our assumption is that the England players are going to be able to select their own teams.
Make their own way, effectively.
And make their own decisions. And if the ECB were to go down the route of a full draft, just to pursue that for a minute, there's going to be huge disquiet about that, because let's take the example of the Vipers at Hampshire, okay? Charlotte Edwards has spent years curating a squad of players for the Vipers who she wants, who are loyal to her, okay? You try telling her there's going to be a draft and there's no way that the current Viper squad is going to be able to stay together. You might be able to get a few of them if you're lucky. She's gonna be really angry about that.
Yeah,
why has she spent
over
time
my cold dead body?
Why has she spent time investing in that squad of players?
No, so clearly, I mean, the point I'm making here really is that the idea of a draft is ridiculous. Not to mention all the logistical issues of the fact that you'll be trying to force people to move from one end of the country to another that in many cases still remain quite poorly paid. And a lot of whom are still living at home and things. So it's not gonna work, and therefore you can't allow Yorkshire to kind of rain all over the rain. It feels almost like a deliberate spoiler tactic from Yorkshire to kind of go, well, we're going to get our own back on Durham. We're not going to let them have any players. We'll keep all the players. Now, they've said explicitly that's not what they're doing, but it sure feels like that's what you're doing.
So here's my answer to Yorkshire, and actually indeed my answer to any team who are unhappy with the current situation. Sure, you take your money and you fund a professional team at your county, that is absolutely your prerogative and you are perfectly entitled to do that. There's nothing in the rules to say you can't do that, but your team is going to play in Tier 2. And, you know, potentially your team is going to tear up Tier 2 because it may be, you know, the only professional team in Tier 2. But if what you really care about is the welfare of the players, which Yorkshire are saying that's what they care about, and you know, you don't want players to move around or to have to pick and to move house, and you care about that rather than the ego of being in the top tier, okay, if that's what you care about, then yes, fine, like, fill your boots. You fund your professional team in Tier 2, and there's nothing that I can see in the rules to stop you doing that at all. And I said this exactly the same thing. I was on Radio Kent a couple of weeks ago when it was announced, and I said, yeah, Kent, fund your Tier 2 team. Fund the professional Tier 2 team. They can play at Beckenham. You can still do everything that you said you were going to do in your bid. You just have to pay for it yourself. So if you really care about that and you don't care about the money side and the ego side of being in Tier 1, then please do that. And I'm sure the ECB would really welcome that. So that would be my response to Yorkshire. I hope that's what Beth Barrett Wild is going to tell them, because I think that to some extent we need to call their bluff here, actually.
Yeah, so it can't be allowed to go ahead.
I do agree with you. But I think we need to welcome this feeling of we really want to have a professional team. And we need to welcome that. We need to harness that and go, yeah, of course, you go for it. That's fine. To be honest, any county over the last 20, 30 years, since the ECB took over, has been able to fund a professional women's county team at their county if they wanted to. There's not been anything stopping them, but none of them have.
Funny that.
It is, isn't it? Anyway, Sid, wow, we've done a bit of a mammoth episode this week. There's been quite a lot to cover. I feel like we've given lots of things quite brief treatment. As ever, we really welcome your comments, so please leave them below the line. Thank you for tuning in, and we will see you in a week's time. Bye-bye.
Bye.